MacCast, Tuesday, March 11th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we are back here for another week of Apple Mac news and tips and tricks and feedback and all that fun stuff that we do on the show. I'm glad to have you back here with me once again. We got lots of good stuff to talk about this week. One of Apple's executives is set to retire. Apple is finally getting proper iPhone car integration, and there's a brand new version of iOS out and available. We're going to talk about all that. We're also going to get to a lot of your feedback. I got a lot of feedback this past week from the prior show, so we got a lot of things to follow up on, plus some new tips and tricks and things to get into, including a cool little tip to go along with Siri and the new version of iOS that's out. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we dive in, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Lynda.com. Lynda.com is a site. They offer high quality, really great video courses to help anyone learn creative software, business skills. If you want to know about photography, video, programming, CAD, if you're a teacher looking to do stuff in the classroom, improve your skills there. They have courses for just about everyone. As a matter of fact, there's over 2,000 different courses, and they're adding new stuff all the time. I was wondering, you know, do they have anything on the new iWork? Sure enough, there is some classes on the new iWork, getting you up to speed with all the changes there. And as a matter of fact, they have great instructors over at Lynda.com too. Well-known names from around the Mac and Apple communities, the tech communities. Richard Harrington from Redpixel, he's been on the MacCast before, great video guy. He actually does the iWork courses, Pages, Numbers, Keynote, that sort of thing. So that just gives you one example of the kinds of quality instructors they have over at Lynda.com. Another thing I really like about Lynda.com is that while they have so many different courses, they make finding the course that you're looking for really easy. They have a great search on there. They have really great organization. There's a lot of cross-linking, so if you need to move from topic to topic. And another real handy thing is, you know, a lot of us don't have a lot of time, so the courses are broken down into blocks, and as you're going through a course, it's going to remember where you're at, and you can come back to it. So if you need to stop, you need to go off, do other things, come back, maybe you want to take some of the skills you just learned, start to apply them, and then come back and learn something new, they make that whole process really, really easy. And I think the best way to experience it really is just to check it out. So if you haven't tried it, we've got a great deal for you. You can get free trial access to the entire library. That's every class and course available on Lynda.com just by going to Lynda.com/MacCast to sign up. And you can check everything out. And then when you're ready to sign up for a plan, they have full access plans starting as low as $25 a month. They also offer gift subscriptions. So if you want to buy a Lynda.com subscription for someone else, they make that really easy too. So student, family member, maybe a teacher, could be anyone. Just go to Lynda.com/MacCast. That's LYNDA.com/MacCast. And there you'll find all the details about their service, the various plans, and you can sign up for your free trial. And a big thank you to Lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. I'm going to kick things off today with some recent numbers from Gartner on Apple's worldwide iPad share. And as always, we've got to dig into the numbers a little bit to kind of get at the real details. Basically, the headline that was floating around this week was that Apple's iPad was losing market share to Android tablets in 2013. But the funny thing is when you start looking into the numbers, Apple's iPad actually outsold the next four best-selling Android tablets combined. Apple sold 70.4 million iPads in 2014, followed by Samsung, Asus, Amazon, and Lenovo, who combined sold 64.4 million tablets. What it ultimately meant, though, was that Apple had 36% of the worldwide tablet market share by the end of 2013, leaving Android tablets with 62%. I'm assuming the other 2% is distributed among other brand tablets like the Surface and Microsoft's tablets and things like that. But the market share comparison of Apple versus Android is always going to be one of those things that's a little bit tricky, and it's always going to more likely go in Android's favor. And certainly from this point forward, now that Android's in the marketplace and there's more and more Android tablets appearing in the space, that's because it's Apple versus every Android tablet out there on the market. And there's a lot of different manufacturers. So it's really a fairer comparison, I think, to go manufacturer by manufacturer. And in that case, Apple still has about double the market share of, say, the next best-selling tablet, which would be Samsung. Apple also is a higher-end part of the market. They're a premium device, and they're really never going to be able to compete with the gray market tablet devices, say, out of China, that are running different variants and forks of Android. Amazon, for example, had 5% of the tablet market share, and their Android is really a fork of Android and probably shouldn't even be compared against Google Android tablets. So it all gets a little bit muddy. But what is clear from the Gartner numbers is that tablet sales are growing, especially in emerging markets, and that's where Android typically does better than Apple. That's just a fact based on pricing, really. And overall, tablet sales were up 68% for 2013, but they were up 145% in emerging markets, 31% in the mature ones, according to those Gartner numbers. So we can expect that the Android versus iOS tablet share race is going to sort of follow along with what happened with smartphones, right? The iPhone slowly lost market share, overall market share, to Android. But once again, I think we need to kind of step back and look at manufacturer versus manufacturer, not just OS versus OS. Because if you really look at it that way, Apple's never going to be on the majority side when it comes to market share. But we can flip around and start talking profits and customer satisfaction, and then the game changes. So you can look at numbers all kinds of different ways and sort of read into them what you want to read into them. But we'll try and stay as balanced as possible. I mean, bottom line is Android's doing very well in its space, and Android tablets are continuing to grow market share, especially in emerging markets. Apple's happy to maintain with the higher end of the market, and they're doing very well in terms of profitability and customer satisfaction. So I think really there's enough room in the space for everybody to grow and everybody to be successful. If you are a fan of Apple's bottom line, and also if you follow along on Apple's quarterly results calls, there's going to be one voice that is going to be disappearing from those calls this year, and that is a big one. Apple's CFO, Peter Oppenheimer, announced that he will be leaving Apple in September of this year. I think actually Apple announced it via a press release. But I have a feeling the guy is going to be pretty missed around Apple, and his tenure at the company was very impressive. So there's going to be some pretty big shoes to fill. Apple says that Oppenheimer oversaw the global expansion of the company during his time there, and also saw annual revenue grow from about $8 billion to $171 billion. Now, the day before Apple actually announced his retirement, Goldman Sachs put out a press release that kind of tipped the press that something was going on with Apple's executive team. Goldman Sachs said that Oppenheimer was going to be joining their company's board of directors. Oppenheimer is going to be succeeded by Luca Maestri, who is Apple's current vice president of finance and corporate controller. You may have not heard his name before, but Maestri has also served as CFO for GM, Nokia, Siemens, and Xerox, and has over 25 years experience. So good pick to take over for Oppenheimer. The official transition is actually expected to begin around June, but there was also another hint that Apple was getting set to change around the CEO position, and it was really only noticed, or at least suggested, by pretty close watchers of Apple's quarterly results calls. Maestri was a new voice on the call and actually took the investor questions toward the end, something that Oppenheimer more typically would have done. So they were probably kind of prepping him and getting him ready to kind of fulfill that role moving forward. So what is Oppenheimer going to do in his retirement besides serve on the board for Goldman Sachs? Well, Oppenheimer said in a statement that for quite some time he wanted to live on the central coast of California and get more involved in his alma mater, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which is actually the alma mater of maybe one of your favorite podcasters. Yeah, actually, I went to Cal Poly, so I had no idea Oppenheimer was from my school. I probably should have known that, but now I do. So I go back there in the summer. Maybe I'll run into him around the streets of San Luis Obispo. But he also said he wants to spend more time with his family and travel and finish getting his pilot's license. So I guess we wish him best in his retirement. Not going to be happening for a while. He should be around at Apple, as I mentioned earlier, through September until Mysteri takes over. So what is it going to take to get your iPhone fully integrated with your automobile? Well, it's going to take actually one of the more expensive accessories that I think Apple has ever produced, and that would be in the form of a brand new luxury car. Apple made its announcement this week of its CarPlay technology at the Geneva International Auto Show, and it made a pretty big splash in the blogosphere. The system was demoed in a Ferrari, but will also be launched in Volvo and Mercedes models this year. There are other models coming. You're going to have Hondas and Volvos and Fords, and other companies have said they're on board, but the first units featuring CarPlay, or the first cars rather featuring CarPlay, are going to be a tad more on the expensive side. But if you're able to afford one of those, wow, you're going to have a really nice tight integration. The integration comes via a lightning cable. You do have to dock it in. It is not wireless yet, although it sounds like Mercedes is looking at ways to make that connectivity wireless. You'd think you could do something through Bluetooth, but once you're all plugged in and connected, you're going to have access through the in-car system to Siri, Maps, music, and podcasts. There was also a handful of integrated radio applications, apps like Spotify, Beats Radio, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio. Now, curiously, Pandora was missing, but as Pandora points out, that is something that's already built into a lot of those car infotainment systems, and Apple may not want to integrate it as part of CarPlay. This is something that I just thought of, not something that Pandora said. They might not want to integrate it because they do have their competing iTunes radio service, which is part of the music application that is built into CarPlay. I also assume that other apps and functionality could be added, at least in the future, although Apple hasn't announced any of those quite yet. Now, something surprising that caught the press's attention was that the CarPlay technology interacts with the car infotainment systems that are built on top of BlackBerry's QNX system. And that seems surprising at first that BlackBerry and iOS would be running together. And there does seem to be some confusion in the reports. Some people are thinking that Apple is running their apps on top of BlackBerry system. That's not the case. It's the two working in conjunction, basically communicating each other. That's what's really going on under the hood. For those who don't know, QNX is a Unix-like real-time operating system mainly targeted at the embedded systems market. I think, as a matter of fact, I read over at iMore that QNX from BlackBerry is actually used for nuclear power plant as well, to control nuclear power plants and things like that. So pretty cool stuff. I think it's a BlackBerry owned company. The QNX is actually a microkernel based operating system and runs a number of smaller tasks known as servers. This is a little bit different than most Unix based systems, which have just a single giant kernel, or a monolithic kernel as they call it. And so it seemed shocking at first, but when you kind of understand what's going on, it's really not. Apple's CarPlay and the apps still run on top of iOS. They still use iOS, but then they interact with the systems that are already built into these vehicles. Vehicles have come with QNX-based systems for a while, so you wouldn't want to replace all of that technology. You just want to work with it. QNX is embedded, it has been embedded in car navigation systems for years. And as a matter of fact, Ford recently announced that it was dropping Microsoft's Sync system and going with technology built on top of QNX. And we do know that Ford is one of the partners who is committed to implementing CarPlay at some time in the future. So it's probably going to make it a lot easier. A lot of Android-based car systems are also built on top, or built to interact with QNX. I got to be careful not to say on top of, because it's really a communications layer that goes between the two different systems. BlackBerry, for their part, came out and said, you know what, we've had a long-standing relationship or partnership with Apple to ensure high-quality connectivity with their devices, and that CarPlay is just another example of them extending that partnership with Apple. So my guess is that with both systems being Unix-based, it makes the integration much easier to do, and something that sounds like Apple worked with BlackBerry a little bit to make happen. Now, exactly how does the integration work? I think it's going to take a little while before we know the exact details, but there was some hints from Volvo. They said that data from the iPhone's display is sent to the vehicle's in-dash screen via an H.264 video stream, very similar to the way that AirPlay mirroring works with your Apple TV. But, you know, one key is that the system is obviously two-way. You've got to be able to interact with the touchscreen in the car and then have commands and things go back to the iOS layer. That half seems to work similar to the way, when I read it, the way it was described, it kind of sounded to me like the way the remote app works on your iOS device to work in conjunction, say, again, with your Apple TV, something like that. Basically, the dash touchscreen returns input to a monitoring and control, or to monitoring and controlling events that would be part of the CarPlay system. So you've got real-time video, I'm assuming, with a layer of controls on top of it, something that's controlled by the QNX-based system, but is broadcast from the iOS layer that's built into the phone. We do know that the new update, iOS 7.1, did bring CarPlay support to the operating system. So there's a couple of different things going on here, but it sounds like streaming video to the display, video mirroring, that sort of thing, with some sort of touch and control layer on top of it going back and forth between the car system and your iOS device. And while the CarPlay system will offer users a convenient, consistent experience inside CarPlay, each manufacturer's integration of the technology does kind of show slight variations. If you go and you look at the different videos from Volvo versus Mercedes versus Ferrari, they're all using different technologies and layers. It also looks like they can layer in and around the CarPlay interface their own controls and layers. As a matter of fact, in the Mercedes video, it seemed to have climate controls and some other things sort of just outside the CarPlay interface, so you could interact with both at the same time. So it does seem to be this kind of loosely coupled integration to me. As far as how all of the integrations look, Volvo seemed to be the nicest. And for some reason, when I was listening to their video, I don't know if they enhanced it or used maybe an international voice or something like that, Siri sounded a little bit cleaner than especially the Mercedes video. Video, which was actually Mercedes, I think they put out a video for the press that leaked online, and it was like a bunch of cutscenes that I think normally you would cut up and put into a newsreel or something like that. So it was really boring to watch and not very exciting. But Siri was really hard to understand in their video. In the Volvo video, it sounded better than Siri on my iOS device. So I don't know if they're doing some tweaks or maybe installing different voices within their system. Another thing that I got kind of excited about is Mercedes is doing some different things. They're investigating an aftermarket integration for some of their older model cars. They don't say when or if it's going to be available, but if you have an older Mercedes, you might be able to get an upgrade at some point to get the CarPlay system integrated. But what's more exciting to a guy like me who can't necessarily afford a Mercedes is the idea that it might be possible to do an aftermarket system. So to be able to go maybe into Best Buy someday and actually buy a new stereo or a new infotainment system right off the shelf that I can integrate into my current vehicle. And I guess the key would be that whatever system it is is QNX based maybe, although I think that maybe older model systems in Mercedes might not be based on top of the QNX technology. So maybe they can build some sort of bridge to CarPlay to make that interaction happen. Maybe it'll be a QNX BlackBerry-based bridge, and it'll work with older non-QNX based head units and things like that. Who knows? But I can only imagine we can expect a lot more from CarPlay. It'll be interesting to see if any other car manufacturers announce integration this year, or if it's just going to be these three for 2014 and the rest are going to, or I guess these are really the 2015 models. I think I've been saying 2014 in 2015 and the rest will be 2016 and later. No one else has officially come out, as far as I know, and made any announcements. A business publication in Australia, the Australian Financial Review, did some digging into how Apple is managing its taxes in that country and has called shenanigans. They're saying that they uncovered a method that Apple's been using over the past 10 years to reduce its tax liability in Australia and divert about $8.9 billion in profit tax-free over to an Irish-based company known as Apple Sales International. That meant in the end that Apple ended up only paying about $200 million in Australian taxes for profits made in that country. Something, I guess, that some Australians think it isn't too cool. They feel like they're being a little bit shortchanged on their tax revenue as far as Apple's concerned. Well, how does it actually work? It's just really a case of follow the money. What happens is that Apple sets up this company in Ireland, or has this company in Ireland, I guess I should say, Apple Sales International, and that company contributes money towards the research and development budget of Apple in Cupertino. By making that contribution, that gives Apple Sales International partial ownership of the intellectual properties that make up Apple's products. So then when Apple goes and sells those products internationally, profits from those sales can be sent to Apple Sales International as part of intellectual property licensing fees. And those fees, in the case of Australia, and I assume a lot of other countries, are able to be made pre-tax, coming out of the pre-tax profits or pre-tax income, I guess it were, thereby reducing profits of Apple in that local region, reducing their tax liability, and then they therefore have to pay less taxes on the money made in that country. Tricky? Yeah, maybe. It's smart though, right? Wouldn't you say? And as far as legality, is it illegal? Absolutely no. As a matter of fact, Apple and other companies have been using tax loopholes like this to their advantage for years and years. It's really not just Apple. Many are calling for Apple to quote unquote do the right thing, but that's really not Apple's job or responsibility. Really, they're beholden to their company's bottom line, to their employees, and to their shareholders. And it's these kinds of practices that companies employ to help maximize their profits. If you find, you know, put it this way, if you found a legitimate way to take a tax deduction off of your taxes, would you say, nah, I better not do that because the government really needs the money? No, we don't do that, and we shouldn't really expect our corporations to do it as well. If you do that, well, then more power to you. You're probably a better person than I am, but I'm going to try and reduce my tax liability as much as I can and keep as much of my profit for myself, and that's really just what Apple's doing. Now, for their part, the Australian government has said that it does have plans to attempt to recover the taxes that Apple and others have avoided over the years. Exactly how they're going to do that isn't really clear at this time, but it's going to be this never-ending game of cat and mouse. A loophole will come, a loophole will close, and another one will be found, and it's a game of business and regulations that's pretty much a game that's as old as time. This is nothing really new. It was spun as being a little bit shocking, but that I hopefully clears it up for you and lets you know what's actually going on. Feel free to chime in how you feel about it. You know, maybe I feel differently because I'm not part of, you know, I don't live in Australia. So how about you, our Aussie listeners? Do you think this is, you know, a horrible thing and Apple is cheating you out of a lot of money, or is this just business as usual? Send us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. There seems to be a lot of rumor attention being given to who is going to be producing Apple's next generation processors for their iOS devices, the A8 processors. Actually, this is something that's been going on since, I think, the A6, maybe even before. Maybe we were talking about this back in the A5 days. I forget. As I get older, my memory is sort of fading on me. But it's always been this back and forth of, is Apple going to continue to use Samsung to make their processors? They've been doing it for years. They're the ones producing all the current processors, or is it finally the year that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation is going to swoop in and take over? Apple has supposedly been looking at them for chips. As a matter of fact, I think we've seen or heard about chip designs and prototypes being put together by TSMC, but they have yet to become the sole manufacturer of Apple's A8 processor, AX processors, I guess we should say. Well, sources out of Taiwan this past week claim that TSMC was going to be making the A8 processor for Apple and that Samsung was out. The report said that, The report said that TSMC won, quote-unquote, most of the orders for Apple's next-generation mobile processor. But despite those reports, ZDNet out of Korea just days later said that Samsung had already signed a contract to produce the A8 processor at its Austin, Texas plant and that they were actually in the final stages of testing before beginning mass production. So there seems to be contradictory reports. What I'm guessing is that Apple needs a ton of processors, that they're planning on producing a lot of products and they're going to need a lot of A8 chips and a lot of production to go around, and they're actually hedging their bets. They're going to actually have both companies producing processors, whether they're going to be for all of the same devices. Who knows? It could be that TSMC gets orders for maybe iPad minis and the lower-end smartphones, and that Samsung does the higher-end devices, or vice versa, or a mix and match, or who really knows? I guess Apple really knows who's producing which processors for which devices, but I have a feeling that Apple does not want to continue to have supply constraint problems as they have in the past, and that by having multiple manufacturers, multiple companies who can produce the chips for them, they're able to get more chips and put together more devices, and that means more sales to the people who want those devices when they want them. And that is probably the best thing for Apple to do moving forward. You may be familiar with the saying that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, I'm starting to think that maybe that saying should be changed to there's no such thing as a free app. You all know my feelings about free apps and some of the models that have been springing up surrounding free apps. A lot of people have no problems with what's going on. I tend to like to pay for my apps and not be bothered with all of the constant nagging for in-app purchases and micropayments and ads that come with a lot of the free applications. But bottom line is usually someone somewhere has to pay in one way or another. Even a totally free application without ads and any other kind of monetization, someone paid with their blood, sweat, and tears, possibly to create that app, although we're finding out now that maybe we can just buy a cheap template and throw it up on the App Store, as we talked about in the last episode, and make some money. But in the real world, one person actually has to somehow pay for the app at some point so someone can make some money so they can make another app. I mean, that's generally how it works for most app developers. And one way that app developers can get paid is through advertising. And Apple has made that process pretty easy with their iAd program, which is a good thing, I think. If you want to put out a free app and you want to make some money off of ads, more power to you. And you can use the iAd system to do that. But it has generally been shown that a lot of times those little banner ads, those little side ads and things like that aren't very profitable. So Apple's been apparently looking at that and thinking about some ideas, and they may have come up with an idea that I'm not so keen on, and I'm curious to know if you're keen on it as well. Definitely not opposed to ads being in apps if that's what you want to do, but Apple might have plans to do big A, what I call big A style ads, the ads that you cannot avoid, the ads that you cannot run away from. It's those giant interstitial ads that pop up full screen right in the middle of your game, right in the middle of your launching of your application, and you can't run away. And worse yet, some of those ads could end up being full screen video advertising. They've supposedly been playing around with it and are getting ready to possibly launch it later this year. Joy. No, not really joy. I'm not looking forward to that. The motivation, though, is, you know, cash, right? We have to get paid. Interstitial ads get a premium price from advertisers over those little tiny banners. They can't be ignored. They're going to be seen. And that means more money for Apple. That means more money for app developers. So I guess that can be a good thing. I find them particularly annoying. And I really could see them at first maybe popping up in the free iTunes radio service, which may be one reason I'm glad I'm an iTunes Match subscriber and I can avoid the ads altogether. I had those full screen interstitial ads come up in Pandora. If you've been a free Pandora user, you probably know what that experience looks like. I actually find it very distracting, especially if I'm driving, something like that. I think they're somewhat dangerous, but I would also fully expect to see them crop up in a bunch of free apps. How frequently, how often is probably going to be up to the app developer. There are already some third-party ad services out there that use them, so you may have seen some of this style ad already pop up in your apps. I am just, frankly, not a big fan, but I totally understand the motivation for the iAd program for app developers who might choose to implement this. I think just personally, I'm going to try to avoid those kinds of applications, and if I see one in an app that I'm using, I probably will promptly uninstall it. And now we get to the big news of the week. This happened, I think, just yesterday. Apple released iOS 7.1. They've been working on this one for a while, and it brings a number of improvements and bug fixes. Actually, a surprising number of new user interface and usability tweaks, as well as settings that a lot of people are particularly excited about. Some of the things you're going to notice right away is design changes in the phone dialer. The phone call buttons are now random. Power off buttons are round, cancel buttons are round, so lots of smaller round buttons rather than going full screen across the bottom of the screen. The user interface has also been said to be made more snappier, a little bit faster. The animations are faster, the transitions are faster. A number of people are actually noting that there are huge speed increases for older hardware like the iPhone 4. So if you've been running iOS on an older device and you've been unhappy with the performance, you probably do want to grab this update and see if you get a little bit better performance out of that older device. The calendar has some nice new features, including this dedicated list and tray view button. Everything kind of slides down and makes using the calendar app a little nicer. There's some tweaks to the camera application, including a new auto HDR feature and more obvious auto flash and HDR indicators. So a little actual yellow indicator will come up right on the screen so that you know, hey, the flash is on or the auto flash feature is on. Something that catches me off guard all the time. I'll usually not want to be using the flash and then it goes off and you have to kind of readjust. So now you'll be able to see before you take the picture that, hey, dummy, your flash is on. There's all kinds of accessibility tweaks as well to increase things like contrast and readability. You can turn on button borders. So if you're one of those people like me, I don't really like just the fact that most things that I have to click on are just text. It's not always obvious what's a label versus what you can click on. You can actually go into accessibility and turn on a little button border, which kind of puts a gray-ish or appropriate colored border around your buttons. You can lower the white point to kind of tone down the brightness. I guess a lot of people aren't big fans of the big, bright colored icons. You can actually make those darker. And there's more parallax options, too. More things to turn off a lot of the motion and stuff like that. Give higher contrast, turn down some of the transparency. A lot more finite controls. You'll find most of those things in the accessibility settings. There's also some significant tweaks to the keyboard. Most significantly are the shift and cap locks keys. The colors and the icons are tweaked. I'm not a big fan of this one. A lot of people really like the tweaks. To me, it's just confusing. Everything seems opposite now. So when it looks like I have the shift key on, I don't, and vice versa. Basically, what happens is when the key is off, you have a gray key with a white icon on it, on the shift key, for example. And then when you tap on it, it reverses. So it becomes dark with light, and then, or actually a white background with, I think, almost a gray or dark gray black icon. And then when you're in cap locks mode, you get the little line under the arrow. That one I'm not so upset about, but it's just the fact that the color tweak is 180 degrees from what it was before. So my brain has taken a while to get that. And I've been running iOS 7 since the beta days, and I am now just getting used to that change. I think that changed a couple releases ago. So it's been a month or two for me to get used to that change. How about you? Let me know if you've been confused by that, or if you just flat out like it better and think it makes more sense. Another thing that looks like it went away is in one of the later betas of 7.1, you had the ability to go into the accessibility settings and manually turn on the darker keyboard. So the keyboard is normally kind of light. They had a darker version, and as a matter of fact, app developers can enable that. I think Tweetbot uses the darker version of the keyboard. Well, there was a manual control in there. That now looks to be missing. At least when I went in to go look for it, it's no longer there. So hopefully they'll bring that back, because I think that was a nice feature to be able to pick and choose whether you like the light keyboard or the darker one. Also in the release notes, it was noted that Touch ID fingerprint recognition has been improved. I don't know that I've particularly noticed that. I gave a tip on the last episode of the MacCast, something that turned out to not work. If you tried that little tip of turning off motion to get Touch ID to work a little bit better, many of you reported back to me that that didn't work. I had not tried it myself. I think I mentioned that in that show, that it was just sent in by a listener, and I had not had a chance to try it out. Well, it turns out it didn't work. I do have another tip for you coming up later in the show, though, that should work. It comes from our friend Steve Gibson, so stay tuned for that. But also in iOS, there's some additional support for iBeacons, something that's really interesting. iBeacons now can get activated when you just have an iBeacon-enabled application installed. It does not need to be launched and running. It doesn't even need to be running in the background. So normally, prior to this update, you would have to have your application with iBeacon support running in the background. So when you double-tapped the home icon and you brought up the background running applications that need to be in that list for iBeacons to work, now they will work regardless. If you just have the app on your phone, it can send you notifications when you're within range of an iBeacon. Little bit leery about how they're going to handle this one. I could see lots of opportunity for abuse, but hopefully Apple has a handle on that. It certainly does make iBeacons more convenient. That way, when you go into the Apple Store and you have the App Store app, you don't have to have it up and running in the background to actually get a notification, something like that. And then one little warning or caveat for anybody who might be using a hack that existed under iOS 7 to get nested folders. I didn't even know this was possible, but I guess there was a nested folder bug, one that was pointed out by the unofficial Apple weblog. If you want to know how to do it, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But there was this trick where you could use a bunch of tabs, some finger juggling to actually get nested folders, so folders within folders in iOS 7. That bug apparently has been fixed in 7.1, so if you are reliant on that bug and you like having your nested folders, you're going to not want to upgrade. So I saw that piece and just wanted to point that out. Something else, as happens usually when Apple releases a new version of the operating system, people go poking around to see if there's any hints of new Apple products coming out. This time around, they found a couple of indicators that there might be some new iPad models on the horizon. You got to take these with a grain of salt, because Apple has in the past put in kind of fake identifiers to kind of throw people off. But a couple of sites noticed that there was iPad 4.3 and iPad 4.6. The speculation is that they might be some minor hardware revisions coming to the iPad. They didn't really note specifically which models those might be, at least in the reports that I saw. But it could also be that Apple's just planning some overseas market models, maybe for markets like China, new mobile versions for, say, China Mobile, something like that. It could be all that's there. So not too many people reading a lot into those new indicators. And then Apple actually had some fun with some of the security patches and updates this time around. They gave credit to the Evaders jailbreaking team for pointing out some of the security bugs that they patched in this latest release. These would be bugs that were typically exploited so that you could actually do jailbreak. And so Apple is obviously paying attention to what the jailbreaking community is up to, keeping tabs on how they're getting in and quickly patching things up. But this is really nothing new. What is new is Apple actually giving credit to the jailbreak team for finding the bug. So that was a little bit funny, and it's in the release notes if you want to look through there. And then along with iOS 7.1, Apple also did update the Apple TV. There's an update, Apple TV 6.1. It has some nice new interface tweaks. As a matter of fact, when I did my upgrade, it prompted me and gave me the option to learn a little bit about how to move my application icons around, something we've been able to do for a while, but Apple didn't really make that front and center. Another thing that they made front and center was the ability to actually hide applications. Apple's been adding more and more channels, and if you're like me, you don't have a cable subscription, a lot of those channels and content you can't access. Well, in the prior version of Apple TV, and we've talked about this trick on the Maccast, you could go into the accessibility settings and actually hide different applications. That is now been brought more forward. You can actually hide them from the main screen. You can also find the buttons for hiding them right from the main menu. So when you go to settings, main menu, you'll see the options to actually hide those buttons. If you want to just do it from the main home screen, you can hold down the select button on your remote so you get the little app wiggle, and then select the icon you want to hide, press the play pause button, a new dialog will come up, and it will give you the option to actually hide that channel or that application. I like to call them channels. I don't know what you guys call them. If you call them apps, you call them channels. I think for Apple TV, it's appropriate just to call them different channels. So if you don't need the Disney Channel apps, for example, or the Disney channels, you can hide those. So that really helps just clean up the Apple TV interface. And so that's a nice little addition there. Another thing that Apple did, speaking of channels, they added a channel for the first U.S. iTunes Festival. That's going to be happening this week during South by Southwest. Apple's going to be live streaming and also making available recorded versions of concerts from acts like Coldplay, Soundgarden, Keith Urban. You can go in the app. There's also an app for iOS that was released. You can go in and you can check those out. You can watch them live, or you can come back and see the pre-recorded versions. They typically keep those around for a week or two. If you have not heard of the iTunes Festival before, it's actually something Apple's been doing for a while in the UK. In the UK, it's like a month-long series of concerts that they put on, live concerts, and then they record and stream them to Apple TV and to an iTunes Festival app. This time around, they're adding the U.S. as a location during South by Southwest. I think that runs for about a week. Didn't do a lot of my research on that one, so I apologize if I'm getting that all messed up. But it's going to be going on for the next couple days if you want to check that out. And then also, along with the Apple TV update, there was an update to the remote app. Version 4.2 is out. You can grab that through the App Store. And the big thing here is Apple added iTunes Radio and direct selection of TV shows, movies, rentals, and music videos right inside the remote app. So it used to be you'd have to go find that stuff in, say, the iTunes app or the videos app, something like that, start streaming that via AirPlay or start playing it on your Apple TV, and then you could just control it with a remote. Now, within the remote, you can actually browse your iTunes radio stations, you can look at your purchased TV shows and movies, your rentals, and actually kick them off right from the remote application. So that makes that a little bit more convenient and handy. And then finally, for the news for today, Mac OS X, 10.9.2, is just barely out to consumers. You probably grabbed that update over the last week or so. And Apple has already pushed out 10.9.3 beta to its developers. So they're already hard at work at the next version of Mac OS X Mavericks. Apple is specifically asking developers to focus on testing the graphics drivers and the audio. Now, despite some continued complaints, it seems like they're not mentioning anything related to Mail. Now, personally, I haven't had too many issues with Mail.app, but I know many people have. And as a matter of fact, I noticed on the App Store this week that, Airmail is one of the top-selling apps on the Mac App Store right now. I've even thought about checking that one out. I know some of you have recommended that to me as a really good replacement, and it's only like $1.99. I'm just so afraid to move my mail out of Mail.app because I've been using it for so many years, and I've kind of got it working the way I really, really like it. So I don't know, but nothing related to Mail, at least in the 10.9.3 beta, the first version that's out to developers. And Apple also didn't mention in its release notes, but 9to5 Mac noticed that the new build has some features to let Mac users set their 4K monitors to run at a pixel doubled retina resolution. So there's some tweaks and enhancements to make the 4K experience better on Macs. And that seems to be the direction that monitors are moving into. You know, everything's higher resolution, retina resolution, 4K resolution. And as a matter of fact, some users are also reporting that 10.9.3 has unlocked the ability for the late 2013 Retina MacBook Pro to run 4K displays at a refresh rate of 60 hertz, which is going to provide a much smoother, better experience for those units. The MacBook Pro, I think, was the only, or the Mac Pro, rather, excuse me, the Mac Pro was the only model so far that was supporting 60 hertz 4K displays. Previously, the Retina MacBook Pro was limited to 30 hertz. So bottom line is Apple is looking to up their 4K display support for future releases of OS X, or at least it's looking that way. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is SaneBox. You know, I had heard about SaneBox for the longest time, and it wasn't until I picked up David Sparks' email book that I really paid attention. He talks about how great SaneBox is in that book at reducing just the, not the volume of email you get per se, but the priority of the email that you get. I don't know how I survived without it. We all get a ton of email coming in, but as you know, that email has different priorities. And if you've got hundreds of emails in your inbox, actually finding and organizing and managing all that stuff can be a hassle. And that's where SaneBox comes in, because what it does is it automatically cleans up your inbox by moving the less important emails out of the inbox automatically, letting you focus on really the urgent, important stuff, the stuff that you really care about. And then it allows you to get to that other stuff later. I call it inbox less. A lot of people talk about inbox zero. I'm calling it inbox less. My inbox went from literally hundreds of messages a day to just a few dozen of the most important ones like your emails. But I also get all that other stuff. I get newsletters, I get order receipts, I get registration confirmations, forgot password things. Still important stuff, but it doesn't need to be in my inbox. It doesn't need to be right there in my face. I can come back and get to that later, maybe later in the day, at the end of the day, brush through it, file it, do with it what I need. And SaneBox allows me to do that. And best of all, it works everywhere. Any email provider, any client, any device, works with iOS, Mac OS X, if you're on an Android device, if you use web-based, doesn't really matter. It's going to handle all that stuff. So basically what it does is it sets up a bunch of different mailboxes for you. You sign up for the service. It gives you a couple default mailboxes. They have some specialized ones. So it really sets up these rules and things that are smart. It actually watches your email, not just watches the email and what's in it, the email and the subjects and things like that, but also watches what you do with it. So it pays attention to which emails do you open, how often do you open them, how much time do you spend with them. So it's really smart about what it does, and the training is that makes the training super easy, right? You don't have to do anything, and if it makes a mistake, all you do is move the message to the appropriate place, and SaneBox will remember that preference. And I've noticed I only have to do it like one time. So if it accidentally puts something I want in newsletters inside my inbox, I move it to newsletters, and the next time I get a newsletter email, it goes to the right place. It is really smart and easy. Has a ton of other features like one-click unsubscribing. You can snooze emails. So if you have that thing that comes into your mailbox, but you need it to deal with it a week from now, you can put it a week off or a day off or a month off. You can actually set up all kinds of different schedules. And what it'll do is at that time, pop that back into your email so that you can deal with it back into your inbox. And you can move attachments to Dropbox. It has integration with that. Really great service. And you can try it for free, plus get a $10 credit by going to SaneBox.com/MacCast. So you can go there, get all the details, sign up, get a free trial, $10 credit. Again, I don't know how I lived without it, and I think you're really going to like it too. So check it out, SaneBox, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we've got a bunch of stuff to follow up on from the last episode. Something about that episode triggered a lot of feedback from you. Starting off with the comments about FireWire drives and Mavericks, specifically FireWire 800 drives. And someone had told me that under OS X 10.9 and even through 10.9.2, that any connected FireWire 800 drives were not spinning down. And lo and behold, I had just recently attached an older Seagate FireWire drive to my Mac running Mavericks. I had just upgraded. And sure enough, that drive is not spinning down even when my MacBook Pro goes to sleep. Well, at least one listener said that he's been having no issues with his FireWire 800 drive. His is a MyBook drive from Western Digital, and he says that his will spin down when his iMac goes to sleep. So I'm not sure exactly what the difference is, but we did a little bit of back and forth and found out he is using a powered drive, not a bus powered drive. So I'm thinking that maybe the issue is limited to just USB, or rather FireWire 800 bus powered drives. That may be the thing, but I can guarantee you that I have one that is not shutting down, and it is getting a little bit warm. So I worry about the longevity of that drive. Hopefully it's something that Apple will address and fix. Until then, pretty much the only fix is to unmount and completely unplug the drive. Eric wrote in and said, you know, I might have a little bit of a trick that you could try out, and that is using a command line tool called Sleep Watcher. This has been around for a while, and you can download it or install it from Mac ports or Homebrew. You can also get it directly through the developer's website. It is a command line tool, so you're going to have to do a little bit of terminal hacking to get it to work, but essentially what it does is it will allow you to watch for times when your Mac goes to sleep or wakes from sleep, and then trigger different scripts to run. You could do Apple Script or Terminal Scripts. So what you should be able to do is run this and then set up a command line, a terminal script, to actually unmount your FireWire drives when your Mac goes to sleep, and then remount them when they wake from sleep. And this would be a perfect solution if it weren't for the fact that this bug seems to impact the drives even when they've been unmounted or ejected. So even ejecting the drive doesn't seem to fix the situation. You actually have to physically unplug the drive from the FireWire port to get it to spin down. And I also don't know how the terminal command would react if the drive was actually busy with a read-write operation. I think it would actually kill the script and wouldn't allow the script to run. So if you were trying to set this up, you'd probably want to put in some sort of delay or something to recognize when the drive didn't go to sleep or didn't unmount, and then take the appropriate action, or to actually maybe delay and wait till the drive finishes whatever active operations it's running and then shut it down. So Eric, unfortunately, that's not going to work in this situation, but it was a good tip, and I still wanted to share it because Sleep Watcher has a bunch of other applications, and people out there might not be aware of it. The other thing we've been talking about on the last few episodes was a simple database replacement for Bento. Since FileMaker's no longer making the Bento product anymore, really, if you want to run a database, at least with a really nice GUI and things like that, something that you're not going to have to set up maybe a SQL server for, then there really wasn't anything you could do other than maybe jump up to FileMaker, which can be a little bit expensive. It really depends on the application, and several of you wrote to explain, you know, FileMaker is really powerful and it's worth the cost if you have the right application. And I don't dispute that at all. But, you know, Bento was a sub-$100 or I think around $100 database. And it was great if you were running a small club or a church organization, something like that. It was a better way to go if you needed to do that sort of thing. A few of you suggested maybe just running a numbers spreadsheet, something like that. But then you don't get those nice forms that you can fill. It's really nice if you're running a club and you're doing, like, say, check-ins, or you need to update information at a meeting, if you have more of a database style application. And so several people have written in to say that Tap Forms, that was one of the applications that we talked about as an alternative. Tap Forms seems to be the big winner. And several of you told me that Tap Forms actually is better than Bento, and it now has support for importing your Bento templates and files. So I think you can actually bring your Bento data into Tap Forms. So that would be the one I would recommend people check out, just based on listener response. I have no personal experience with it, but it looks nice and sounds like it'll do the job. And as I promised earlier, I have a better fix for the Touch ID fading phenomenon. That's the issue a lot of people were reporting, where their Touch ID, they would set it up on their iPhone 5S, and then over time, slowly, it would recognize their fingers and their touches less and less. And I mentioned a trick that a listener had sent in, saying that by disabling the motion options in accessibility, or reducing the motion via the accessibility menu, that seemed to help improve his Touch ID responsiveness or recognition. And a number of you tried that. I had not personally tried it at that time, and it turned out it didn't work all that well, or didn't work at all, according to some of you. Luckily, Tim wrote in to tell me that he had heard Steve Gibson claim on a recent Security Now that he had found a way where you could actually get more scans of each finger than just the default ones that are done when you initially set up Touch ID. So one of the workarounds had been to go back in and just reset up Touch ID, reset up those fingers. So delete the ones that you have in there and go through the setup process again. Well, that can be pretty cumbersome. What Steve Gibson discovered is that when you go into settings under Touch ID and passcode, you'll need to enter your passcode. But then when you're on the Touch ID screen, you can look at the fingerprints section, and that will show you each one of the fingerprints that are set up there. And usually I think it'll say fingerprint one, fingerprint two. And we've covered this tip in the past on the MacCast, where if you actually tap in that area, you'll get a keyboard and you can actually label those. A lot of people don't know that. You can actually set labels on those fingerprints. So you can say, this is my thumb, this is my index finger, or right index finger, left index finger, whatever you want to do that's going to allow you to remember those. But another little trick that you can do is, when you're on that screen, if you tap or hold on the Touch ID sensor, then briefly you'll see that finger, if it's recognized, that slot light up in gray and then kind of fade in and fade out. So it'll show you which finger that is that you're touching to the Touch ID sensor. What Steve Gibson discovered was that when you're actually doing that touch, what it's doing is it's actually capturing and recording that data as another scan. So the theory is that Apple made a balance during the setup. They didn't want to have you have to keep touching your finger to that sensor for, you know, say 1,000 scans or something like that, so they could get a more accurate reading. They kind of made a cutoff. They said, okay, this is enough touches that we have enough information that we can get this thing to work. And what you can do then is you can go in later using this mechanism and add additional scans, and you can sort of adjust your finger more and put more data into the Touch ID slot for that finger. It's actually going to keep adding and building up that map of that finger as you touch, and you can touch as many times as you want. So the trick is just go back in there and spend a little time and maybe do a few dozen other touches, and make sure that you move your finger around, that you kind of get the edge of that finger and maybe the tip, and rotate it and put it at different angles and stuff like that, so that it gets a full complete scan of that finger, and that seems to improve the accuracy. Also, as I mentioned earlier, iOS 7.1 is supposed to fix some of the accuracy issues surrounding Touch ID, so it should just get better naturally. But if you want to give it more data to work with, sounds like this is going to be a good way to go. And originally, I believe that every time you do a successful scan when you're unlocking your phone, it's also supposed to be adding to the data, but maybe that's just not enough data to get it to be really, really accurate. So if you've been having trouble with your Touch ID sensor, or maybe you got a cut on your finger, certain things have changed with your fingerprint over time, you might want to go back in and just give it some more data points, some more information, and that may help actually help improve your reliability. And if it does, let us know. If this trick works for you, I did it, and I seem to be getting more accurate Touch ID, although I still am failing every once in a while, so it's definitely not 100%. I don't know if you can ever get to 100% accuracy, but I would say 95 to 98% of the time, I am getting in on the very first scan. So that seems to be working well for me. And then the last thing we have to talk about is, we talked a little bit about smart playlists in iTunes, and I mentioned a smart playlist I had set up to kind of find and identify my iTunes tracks that were matched with iTunes in the cloud, or matched with iTunes Match, but were at the lower bitrate. So the ones that I have basically eligible to be upgrading, and I could put them in a playlist and I could delete them, but then I had to go back into my main library and kind of sort by the column and find those actual tracks to actually re-download the higher quality versions. Well, Nathan passed along a script. He thinks it originally came from someone else. He thinks possibly Chris Breen over at Macworld figured out the smart playlist, but there is a way to set up a smart playlist that'll show you all of your matched tracks that are not stored locally on your computer. So stuff that's matched is in iCloud, but is not on your local computer, making it really easy to download everything in a batch. Because once you have something in a playlist, even a smart playlist, you can click one button and it will download every track that's in that smart playlist. So what you do is you go under File, New, choose Smart Playlist, and then you're going to set this up to match all of the parameters. So the parameters are going to be where a track's location is iCloud, and also where the location is not on this computer, and the media kind is music. So that's going to find everything that's in iCloud, not on the local computer, and where the kind is music. And then you can enable live updating, and it will find all of the tracks that are up in iCloud that you don't have downloaded locally to your computer. And in my case, that's going to be anything that I just deleted from that other playlist. So that works out really convenient for me. So click OK, give that thing a name, and you can keep coming back to that as you find new tracks that you want to re-download in the higher quality format. So thanks, Nathan, for passing that along. That actually worked out really well for me. And I think that's all the feedback that we had from the last episode. Now I want to move on. I got a couple of little iOS 7 things to tell you about. One was an issue that I ran into on my iPad after updating to iOS 7.1. Immediately after it ran the install, and I just did the over-the-air update, when I did that, my iPad reset, rebooted, did its thing, saw the white Apple logo, up came the lock screen. I did the whole slide to unlock, and then I tried entering my passcode. And when I started tapping on the screen, it seemed to be unresponsive. So I was doing my taps, I tapped in my passcode, and you know how the buttons, the little circles will light up? They didn't light up. And I thought, oh, that's weird. And I tried it again, and I tried it again. And then several seconds later, all of a sudden, they all started lighting up really, really fast. So there was this huge delay in recognizing any of my key presses, not only on the keypad for the passcode unlock, but also once I was in and accessing my device, when I went to surf the web, anywhere I went to put in text, it had this huge, huge delay, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. It was basically not recognizing any of my key presses. I thought, oh, I'm going to have to do a restore. This is awful. But before I did that, I went and did some Google searching and found a thread on Apple's discussion board where I wasn't the only person having this issue. So in case you've run into this issue after upgrading to iOS 7.1, there actually is a simple little fix, and it worked for me, so hopefully it'll work for you. If you go into Settings, General, and then under Reset, there's an option called Reset Keyboard Dictionary. You tap that, you're going to have to enter your passcode, and then another screen will pop up, or a little panel will pop up, and warn you that when you do this reset, it will delete any custom words, or all custom words, rather, that you've typed on your keyboard that have been put into Apple's dictionary. So I'm assuming those things are, would be things like names, like I'm sure my last name was in my custom dictionary, all the autocorrect things that, you know, are specific to you. All of those things are going to be lost if you do this reset, but in my mind, it's a small price to pay to actually get keyboard functionality back on your iOS device. So if you're okay with that, go ahead and tap the reset dictionary option. It's going to clear that out. And that, for me, fixed all the trouble with this delayed keyboard, and it hasn't come back. So I'm assuming I'm going to have to rebuild up that dictionary, but there must be some sort of corruption that happens in there that causes this problem on certain iOS devices. Now, my iPhone is also having a weird issue, but it had been prior to the release of 7.1. So it might be related to the earlier beta software. That one I might end up having to do a restore, but it's more the kind of thing where my iPhone is stalling or locking up or just becoming unresponsive for a second or two, not just with the keyboard, but I'll go to launch an application or press the home button and just nothing will happen, and I'll have to wait several seconds and then suddenly it'll kick in. So I tried the reset on my iPhone, just before I started recording the podcast. I don't know if the dictionary reset's going to work for that or not, or if it's some other issue. But if you've run into that problem and have a fix and maybe it's something different, let me know about it, maccast@gmail.com, because it's something I'm having trouble with. And I'd like to avoid having to do a full reset of the phone, but I will if I have to. And so the next thing I have is actually a little trick, something that was enabled in iOS 7 and the iOS 7.1 update. And I think this is going to be really handy for me. If you use Siri, you know, I'm a big fan of Siri, so I use Siri quite frequently. You've probably run into the situation where you're either in a noisy environment or you're starting to talk about something or ask Siri something and you kind of pause a little bit too long, and then Siri thinks you're done and kicks in and starts doing her stuff, right? She cuts you off and then you don't get in your full command or your statement or what have you. Well, now you can actually press and hold the home button. That will activate Siri as normal. But if you don't let go, Siri will keep listening to whatever you're saying until you actually let go of the home button. So you'll see the little waveform line there as long as you don't let go. And then the minute you let go, Siri's going to go off and do her stuff. So that can be really helpful in that kind of situation where you might be in a noisier environment or you think you might pause a little bit too long while you're speaking, and you can actually get your full statement in before Siri just butts in and goes off searching the web or what have you. So that's a nice little trick. So play around with that and see what you think. Now I have to get a little bit serious, because this next topic really isn't a fun one, but I think it is kind of a necessary one. And it was actually something that was triggered by a news piece that I saw as I was doing my research for the show this week. And as a matter of fact, we did a whole episode of this for the Mac Roundtable number 217. It happened after we lost our dear friend and podcaster, Tim Verporten. I'll have a link to that episode in the show notes at maccast.com, because it sort of goes deeper into this topic. But it's basically making sure that your technology and your Mac and your iOS devices are ready for when you pass on. What happened this week is a pair of brothers found out that Apple makes it really hard to get access to a locked device, even if the device's owner has passed away. What happened was they had an aunt, or it might have been their mother, I can't remember the specifics, but a close person in their family pass away, and they wanted Apple to factory restore or unlock the device. They tried to factory restore, I guess, and couldn't get into the device, and they asked Apple support for help. But they were told that they were going to need to provide a copy of the death certificate, a copy of the will, and a letter from the solicitor, along with a court order before Apple would unlock the iPad. And I'm sure there's a bunch of legal mumbo jumbo and reasons why Apple can't do this, but they sort of felt that, you know, Apple was being not very sympathetic to their situation at a time when they're grieving, and it's an awful time for their family. But, you know, I don't know enough about the nuances to be able to say one way or another what Apple's situation is or why they take this particular stance. But I do know that in February, Apple updated their iCloud free account terms and conditions with a warning that says, quote, "You agree that your account is non-transferable and that any rights to your Apple ID or content within your account terminate upon your death." So that certainly makes it sound like at least legally you've agreed that once you pass on, your account has been kind of negated and would not be accessible by other people, I guess, unless they would actually know the information to get into that account. And as we increase security for our devices and our online accounts, it's really going to become important that we inform our loved ones and people that need to know how to get access to those devices and accounts if we're no longer able to. And it might not just be your death. It could just be that you somehow become incapacitated and somebody needs to be acting as a beneficiary or acting on your behalf. So I would say at the very least, give verbal instructions to your loved ones, but you probably should really consider writing down some instructions and having a printed out list of your passwords, or at least letting people know. If you're like me, you use an application like 1Password, teach your family members and loved ones how to gain access to that. Give them the passwords. Put the passwords in a safe deposit box or leave them with your lawyer as part of your will. However you need to do it to get that information. And if you need to change or update that information, obviously you're going to have to update this sort of backup copy or these instructions for your loved ones. But I would hope that none of us get into the kind of situation that these poor brothers are having to go through. And I feel very sympathetic for them. But I don't know if I'm willing to go so far to say that, you know, this is something that Apple has to make conditions for. I think we have to sort of pre-plan and make conditions for that. It sounds like they can get in, but they're going to have to jump through a bunch of processes and loopholes and do a bunch of things that they probably don't want to do at this point. They probably just want to deal with their grieving and their loss and then move on with their lives. And so we can make this a lot easier for the people that we leave behind if we just do a little bit of preparation in advance. And that's what that whole Mac Roundtable was about. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that, I encourage you to. Now, I don't often talk about apps, specifically about specific apps for iOS devices on this show, but I ran across one this week that I thought was particularly interesting, given the fact that one of the issues of doing content creation on iOS devices is very often we're limited in terms of the fonts that we can use for, say, like Pages or a keynote presentation, something like that. And it's always kind of been that way. You have this limited sort of subset of fonts compared to what you could get on your Mac. And that's been one of the complaints about people who use iWork, is having to stick with this limited set of sort of fonts that work on both platforms if you want to be able to have cross compatibility. If you want to move from iOS to OS X and back and forth seamlessly, you kind of had to stick in this little sandbox of fonts. But my interest was piqued when the unofficial Apple weblog mentioned this really cool app that will allow you to install any TrueType or OpenType font on your iOS device, and you can do it without having to do a jailbreak. The app is called AnyFont. It's $1.99 in the App Store. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. I haven't personally tried it yet, but I'm going to be downloading it. I just literally found out about it as I was doing research for today's show. And I know it's likely going to work pretty well, because the way it works is by putting the fonts in iOS profiles. And that's something that iOS does allow, and it allows for that to happen. So if you can get a font in there, it sounds like it's made available to the operating system, and any app that can access fonts is going to be able to use the fonts that you load in there. So you can add, as I mentioned, TrueType fonts or OpenType fonts, and you can do it either by moving them over via iTunes, you know, through the applications in iTunes, you can copy it over to the app, or you can use the OpenIn feature in iOS. So I'm assuming that means you could go to a place like Google's Open Fonts and grab the TrueType fonts from there and then open them up inside the AnyFont application. And then once installed, it's going to appear in Settings General in the Profiles section. So if you ever need to remove it or get it out of there, you need space, you just go in there and you delete the profile, and then the font will go away. But when it's there and installed, then inside Pages or Keynote, you can access those specialized fonts. And so if you have documents you're working on, you've set them up on your Mac and they have these really specialized fonts, you can now take those, load those into Pages on iOS, and get more cross-platform capabilities. So I thought that was pretty cool and well worth checking out. And then finally, in the show notes for today, I had a question from Fred. Fred has a MacBook Pro. He has an Apple TV, and he often takes those two things on the road with him so that he can, via AirPlay, send video content, movies and TV shows and things, to his Apple TV. And the way he gets internet access when he's on the road is by using a Verizon Jetpack MiFi. So the typical situation is he'll set all this stuff up and then kind of use the Jetpack MiFi as a router. So he'll access connect both his Mac and the Apple TV and the various Wi-Fi devices, iPad, all to the MiFi device, and then use that as a little mini network. But the problem he mentioned in his email was that it was dropping the connection. Specifically, the Mac kept dropping the connection to the Jetpack, which was causing issues with AirPlay. And so his iPad would stay connected, but then and the Apple TV would stay connected, but the MacBook wouldn't. So he'd lose access to the actual content that he was trying to stream and play via AirPlay. And so my first thought was, well, why do you need the Jetpack device at all, Fred? You know, basically what I'm thinking is, why not just set up, or why couldn't you just set up an ad hoc network, basically using your MacBook Pro as the network router? And I have done this in the past for, say, something like Keynote, using a Keynote remote. So I'll have Keynote running on my MacBook. I'll be in a situation where I have the MacBook connected to a projector and I need to use the Wi-Fi to use the Keynote remote functionality, but they don't have internet access or Wi-Fi in the location that I'm at. So I'll have my MacBook Pro set up an ad hoc network and use that. And the way you do it is you go under the Wi-Fi icon in the menu bar and you choose Create Network. And then you can enter a name for your Wi-Fi network. You can set the channel you want it on. And you can even set up a WEP password. Unfortunately, you can't do WPA through that menu. You have to use WEP. But since this is kind of a one-off and ad hoc, you're just setting up a network temporarily, security probably not too big of an issue. So you can do that, and then you can connect your iOS devices directly to the Wi-Fi that's set up by your MacBook, and it'll just, you know, give you a DHCP address and away you go. The trouble I discovered, though, is that while iOS devices can see and connect to that ad hoc network, the Apple TV won't, for whatever reason. And the reason seems to be that the Apple TV wants to see a network with an internet connection. And if you're setting up this ad hoc network, then you don't have an internet connection. So what I realized is the workaround you could use is you could use the Jetpack, which allows you to do USB tethering. So you can actually connect it to your MacBook with a USB tether to give your MacBook an internet connection through the MiFi device, but then set up ad hoc on your MacBook Pro and connect your other devices, your iPad or your Apple TV, directly to that network. So you almost have the Jetpack acting as your internet access in your router, and then your MacBook is set up, or as your let me back up there because I said that wrong. You're using the Jetpack as your internet access, almost like you would a cable modem at home, and then you're using your MacBook Pro as the router that's hooked up to that and sending traffic out to the internet and bringing stuff back in. But then your devices inside that network are connected to your MacBook Pro directly, and that way the traffic is going just from your MacBook Pro directly to the Apple TV and not through the Jetpack device, because I have a feeling that's where things are kind of getting hung up. And you could also do this with an iPhone. So if you don't have a Jetpack, a MiFi device, you can USB tether your iPhone, or even if you're in a hotel and they have wired Ethernet, you could do wired Ethernet to your MacBook Pro and then share out the connection that way. So the way this setup would work is basically you connect to the internet on your Mac, either through the hotel Ethernet or your iPhone USB tether or your Jetpack USB tether. The key here is you cannot use the Wi-Fi, because you're going to be using the Wi-Fi to connect up your other devices. That's going to be the access point for your other devices. So you connect to the internet first through some sort of wired connection, and then you create the ad hoc network the same way I mentioned before. Go under the wireless menu and choose Create Ad Hoc Network, set that up, and then go into System Preferences under Sharing. And the key here is you need to turn on internet sharing, because the Apple TV is going to want to see that internet connection. And since you're going through your MacBook Pro, you're going to have to route through that. So you turn on internet sharing and then you set up the sharing. So what you'll see in there is you're going to share the connection from, and you're going to choose whatever your Mac is connected to. So if that's the USB tether, you'll select that. If it's the Ethernet, you'll select that port. And then you'll check two computers using, and then you're going to say Wi-Fi. That's going to be that Wi-Fi ad hoc network that you set up. So basically you're routing from the Wi-Fi through to the wired internet connection. And then once you have that all set up, you can also put in a WEP password and do all that other, or WPA password, I think in this case, do all that other stuff and get that. And then once you have that all set up, then you're going to go to your devices, to your Apple TV, your iPad, and you're going to connect that to that Mac ad hoc Wi-Fi network. And then it should all work seamlessly. You should be able to get your Apple TV connected. You actually will have an internet connection at that point, so you can go out to the internet and you can surf and do all that stuff. But internally, I would imagine the traffic from AirPlay and stuff like that will just stick on your Mac network between your iPad and your Mac and your Apple TV and vice versa and back and forth. And I have a feeling you're going to get a much more reliable connection. And so that's one way to go. If you need to do all of this without having an internet connection, so if you don't have the MiFi device, you don't have any way to get an internet connection, the only other way I've been able to kind of set something up like this is to use an Airport Express base station as like my ad hoc network. So basically you set up the airport and then it creates this private IP network. You have to kind of trick it a little bit. What you do is you open up the airport utility, you go into configure the airport, tell it that you want to create a network and it's going to use a private IP. I think it'll actually generate it and you're good to go, but you won't have any Ethernet or you won't have it bridging to any other kind of network. It's just going to be this autonomous thing. And then when you go to connect your Apple TV, you'll see the Airport Express. But when you choose to connect, you're probably going to get a connection failed error message, and then you'll get the option to continue without internet. So you can say, yeah, I want to continue without internet, and then the configure IP window is going to come up to configure your IP settings. Just choose automatic, and it's going to pick that up from the DNS that's going to be sent out from the Airport Express, and you'll connect all of your devices to the Airport Express base station like that, right? And they're all going to get self-assigned IP addresses. But that's going to be fine because you just need to have an internal network to send AirPlay video from one device to another. You don't really need to get out to the internet. What the obvious disadvantage is that you're not going to have that internet access. So features that need to be able to go out to the internet, say trailers or iTunes Radio, those things aren't going to work. If you need to pull down movies from the iTunes store, you're not going to be able to stream that stuff. You're only going to have access to the stuff that you have on that local network on other devices. But it should work, and you should be able to do things like do AirPlay mirroring from your Mac to, say, the Apple TV. I've actually used this for presentations, again, where I don't have any kind of internet access. I'll bring my Airport Express. I usually just factory reset it because out of the box, it kind of has all the settings that you already need. It's already set up, but you still will get these warnings that you have no internet access when you try and connect to that. But just for doing a little ad hoc thing, that generally works. So you can try that out. Hopefully one of those little tips or tricks works for you. But with that, that is going to do it for today's episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show's sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can check out all their software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support, for staying subscribed. I really like hearing from you. So if you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, you can send those comments to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. Also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And you'll find the MacCast community on Google+, if you like hanging out there. So wherever you want to go, online, social media, there you go. That's where you'll find me. And until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.